Well, we know a lot more. We know a lot more about the shooting in San Bernardino. And I've got for you also, going to get into that obviously. Got a lot of calls yesterday, and we were just scratching the surface. I've also got some. I did a little bit of research. Well, I found some clips on jihad. The doctrine undergirds all of the stuff that's going on is obviously jihad, but what does it mean? I've told you probably a few times. Everybody knows that it's holy war and everything, but I will get into that. A little bit cold outside, 29 degrees. You got your Friday here, and well, I hope you're gonna get a little rest. But this situation in San Bernardino has not sat very well with me, in part because of this disconnect that I think is at the highest levels of the government. We are in peril, and that's why last Friday, Black Friday, people went out, and there were more background checks off for guns than any time ever seen, set a new record. People are increasingly feeling as if they can only defend themselves. The government is disconnected, and while there are many good members of the police forces, the various police forces, the FBI, the police, the sheriffs, and state troopers or Texas Rangers, whatever, Border Patrol, that people feel like at the highest levels that the government is purposefully dismissing the risk factor and saying that we have nothing to worry about. Now, I just found out that there is supposed to be 85,000 Syrians and some other people brought in, but I think it's going to be mostly Syrians next year. The year after that, 2017, they want to bring in 100,000. And this is why this particular administration has struggled and continued to struggle for approval and enthusiasm these last 7 years. There is a constant series of decisions that are made that are either seen as not in the best interest of Americans in general, put Americans at harm, or that people are just not enthusiastic about. And there is a belief set in these people running the government, and it's on both sides, unfortunately. You can find this idea in both sides that we know what's good. We're driving the bus. You can sit back and relax. There's no reason to get agitated. Your opinion doesn't really mean anything because it's uneducated. It is not an informed opinion. You really don't know what's going on behind the scenes. So just sit back and try not to create a fuss. And this attitude is problematic on a couple of reasons. First of all, these individuals in power do not know everything. Number two, in many cases, their value system is way off, way off. And another problem is that mistakes are made and nobody owns up to them. No heads of departments are ever fired or replaced. So you get the sense that the elites are either doing this on purpose, they're screwing up on purpose to achieve some malign end, or are doing it accidentally and they don't really care. But people are frustrated, and I know that the Democrats are increasingly frustrated with this president. I've got his immediate reaction to this, which I played yesterday, but I think bears repeating.
At this stage, we do not yet know why this terrible event occurred. We do know that the two individuals who were killed were equipped with weapons and appeared to have access to additional weaponry at their homes. But we don't know why they did it. We don't know at this point the extent of their plans. We do not know their motivations. And I just received a briefing from FBI Director Comey, as well as Attorney General Lynch, indicating the course of their investigation. At this point, this is now a FBI investigation that's been done in cooperation and consultation with local law enforcement. It is possible that this was terrorist-related, but we don't know. It's also possible that this was workplace-related. And until the FBI has been able to conduct what are going to be a large number of interviews, until we understand the nature of the workplace relationship between the individual and his superiors, because he worked with the organization where this terrible shooting took place, until all the social media and electronic information has been exploited, we're just not going to be able to answer those questions. But what I can assure the American people is we're going to get to the bottom of this, and that we are going to be vigilant, as we always are, in getting the facts before we issue any decisive judgments in terms of how this occurred.
So he goes on to say, everyone has a role to play to stop gun violence, including our legislatures. So this is all about gun violence to these people. And he did admit that it could be terrorism. I mean, you've got two people with Middle Eastern names that went to a party and just started unloading on people with rifles. So, it's frustrating. You know what? We don't need more gun laws. We need more guns in the hands of private citizens. Because, as I mentioned yesterday, these things seem to always happen in situations where there no one is armed to defend themselves. And you know why is this value? Why is there this value in the left of putting people in situations where they can't defend themselves? I don't get it. I mean, I really, you know, we've got a phone call here. Thanks for the call to the Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
This is Tom.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. It was climate change that forced that couple to go crazy and still kill people.
Of course. I'm glad you reminded me of that. Thank you. All right. Here is Donald Trump's reaction to this. Wonders about the pathetic motives of Obama. That this is why this guy is popular. When I hear the president say we're going to bring in more Syrians after the Paris attack, even though there were Syrians involved in that attack, after the head of the FBI says there's no way to background check these people because they don't have paperwork, when the president gets angry and blames the GOP, and I am just sitting there thinking, let's just say for the sake of the argument that the things that Obama believes are true, does it have to be so painful? I mean, just listening to this guy, listening to him give this statement without his teleprompter, it's just agonizing. You know, it's like watching a worm die at the bottom of a tequila bottle. Yeah. So here's Trump. Well, let me play the Trump clip when we come back. And Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE, 523-1450. 523-1450 at 6:15. Hey, it's Kelly.
Hey, good morning, Kelly. This is Sergio. How you doing?
What's up, brother?
Hey, yeah, I just wanted to let you know, what's your take on this?
Sergio.
In California.
Sergio.
Yes.
Can you hear me? We're not in the air.
Sure.
We're not in the air. You want to hold on?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Sure. It's okay.
I'll put you on hold. Okay, thanks. Well, it's 6:19, and we've got a call from Sergio. Thanks for the call, Sergio. You wanted to talk something about Saudi Arabia?
Well, actually more about the San Bernardino killings.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
I lived about 30, 35 years in California, and the gun control laws there are about like New York. They're meant for elitists only. And I heard you talking about, you know, exercising our right to carry arms.
Yeah,
I don't think it's going to happen in California.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. There is the way that things are presented to us, and this is why we have to educate ourselves to think and get the propaganda out of our minds. The places that have the strongest gun control laws oftentimes have the worst violence. And you know, the reason that General Bernie Sanders is not in favor of gun control is he lives in a state with one of the most lax gun control policies, and they've got one of the lowest crime rates. So anyway, go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say, you know, I lived in California for a lot of years, and there was a time in the 1970s where the police were considered to be too abusive, so the people screamed. Then they got very lax, and then the people screamed again. You know, you got to take control of the streets again.
Okay.
So people are always crying all the time. You can't make them happy. And I think what's going to happen in time is that the people are going to throw up their arms and say, you know, to the government, do what you have to do to get this stuff under control.
Yeah, I agree. Thanks for the call, Sergio. All right, folks, I agree. It's a good point he brings up. I had written a couple of articles on the history of the Second Amendment. And it's always during this kind of research period that I find out, you know, I found it so educational. I would encourage anybody who has an interest and can write at all to try to, you know, research and write articles and get them published, even if it's in a blog. There's so many, this is like the great age of publishing, you know, there's so many different ways to publish things, but I was interested to find out that when the Second Amendment, the roots of the Second Amendment go way back into British history, just as about as far back as we know of. The government made a law that every boy over the age of 7 or 8 had to have a bow and a couple of arrows. And then the government set up practice areas where they had what they called butts, I guess hay bales or something like that to shoot into. And it was a defense of the realm thing, but that's where our right to hold and bear arms comes from. And so if you can think about it in that sense, we're kind of returning back to that because we don't have any way to know. And there's an article about, or I think it's actually a clip I'll have for you on the difficulty of the FBI in tracking down these people, because if you have someone who was raised in America, you assume that they have a certain affection for the liberties and freedoms here, the Constitution. But if they get radicalized, and this guy, Farouk, he was a very religious person. He was looking for a traditional bride, a woman who would wear the hijab. And so he went to Saudi Arabia, and somewhere within this process of meeting this young lady who was from Pakistan and then moved to Saudi Arabia. His family's from Pakistan, and he was born in Illinois. But somewhere along the line, he became radicalized. And the fact of the matter is that the other article that I told you about from yesterday, that Saudi Arabia is an ISIS that made it, you have no idea how draconian the laws are in Saudi Arabia, how extraordinarily, I guess you would say, abusive. And so a lot of this goes, I mean, this obviously goes back to, the Constitution is based on the Quran, is based on Islam. And you've got something called the Treaty of Umar that lays out some things. And the Treaty of Umar is from like you know, like just the like the 8th century, like the 700s, and it prescribed who could do what, and you know, some of the things that it would be illegal under Sharia law. I mentioned you can't have a Bible over there. You can't have a cross. You can't, you know, you can't put up a cross on your house, and they don't allow churches over there, you know? So think about it. The people that come here from the Middle East to demand more religious freedom, they don't, there's no religious freedom, in, Saudi Arabia, for example. You have the government dictating what religion you will believe, and if you proselytize, if you go and try to convert people, that is a crimes if convicted, sentenceable to death, of course, or having a Bible or having a cross. And you know, there's some of the laws are silly, some of them are cruel, some of them are just ridiculous, but unfair, in our eyes at least. But you know, a woman can't drive over there. In that society, a woman is either the ward of her husband or her father. There's just arranged marriages. There's no such thing as dating in Saudi Arabia. You can't be alone with a woman that you're not related to. If you are found in that compromising position, the man's not in trouble, but it is assumed in the law that the woman has had sex with any man that she is in an, you know, if a woman is in a house with a man that she's not related to, she's unmarried, he's unmarried, it doesn't matter if he's married. Marriage, by the way, is, I'll just go into that a little bit, but it is assumed that she has had sex with him. That in and of itself is crazy, isn't it? It's kind of insane. A marriage over there, all right, so marriage under the Sharia law, a man is allowed four wives, up to four wives. But divorce is, I just want to, you know, explain to you, especially in the midst of, in the face of Muslims who often try to lecture Westerners that they don't have any respect for women, that they don't know how to treat women, and, you know, women are not covered and all this stuff and all the prostitution and all the stuff over here. You can decide whether they respect women, but from what I'm going to tell you, man is allowed four wives. Adultery is not a crime, believe it or not. And the reason that is so is because a man can have up to four wives. The wives do not have the right to ask for fidelity from the husband because he has up to four wives. And then there is something called temporary marriage, which is called muta under Shia law, and it's there's mizir is the style of temporary marriage in Sunni, and the most common form of marriage in Iran and also in Saudi Arabia is temporary marriage, which can last from a year to 99 years, and there also prostitution is common. And also a concubine. Islam has never made illegal slavery. Slavery is still technically legal. And also a man can divorce his wives at the drop of a hat. And it just takes what they call the troubled repudiation. I divorce thee, I divorce thee, I divorce thee. If a man says that to his wife, even if he said it as a joke, she's divorced. He cannot remarry her. She's got to go get married to somebody else and then divorce to return to the marriage if that was their goal. Even if he says it when he's drunk. And people can be married. Women can be married by proxy and divorced. You can divorce a woman through a text. If you send a triple text to a woman, I divorce thee or I divorce you. You're divorced. That's their idea of marriage. So anyway, that's just one element of the law to let you have an insight into how different it is over there. Let me play this clip here for you from Trump responding to the president's reaction to this dreadful shooting.
frontrunner. Donald Trump is with us. His latest poll numbers have him at 37% and apparently very scared, a very scared Republican establishment. How are you, sir?
Hi, Sean.
Sad, isn't it?
It's pathetic. We have a president that doesn't want to talk about the problem, and you're not going to solve the problem unless you're willing to talk about it. Something's going on with him, and I guess a lot of people don't know, but something's in that mind, and this is incredible. You look at what's happening in this country generally, but that he can't even use the proper term is horrible.
At this point, all evidence appears that he was radicalized. The trip to Saudi Arabia, the fact that we have even CNN of all places, and you're right, they have not been particularly nice to you, but even they are now telling us that, in fact, not only he traveled to Saudi Arabia, but he has these terror links, that he had been in communication with a variety of people that were suspected terrorists. You know, so all the evidence points in this direction. We don't have finality on this, but it should be stated as the number one investigative area that they're in.
Well, Sean, I've been saying vigilance. We have to practice great vigilance, whether it's a mosque or any place else. We have to be vigilant, and we're not. It almost sounded like his wife had something to do with the radicalization, but whatever it is, it's not a good situation, and we have a president that doesn't want to admit it. And nobody knows what's going on with him.
Well, it raises questions, too, about the immigration issue. You know, you know, one thing nobody seems to be willing to talk about, you talk about it, I talk about it. If you grow up in Saudi Arabia, and we're told this 28-year-old woman is a Qatari woman, if you grow up and what you have been indoctrinated into, the culture you have been brought up in, tells you that women can't drive cars, women must, again, they went to Saudi Arabia. This is where women can't drive cars, can't be seen in public without a male relative. Under Sharia law in some countries, you need 4 male eyewitnesses for rape. So if you grow up, how do we ascertain somebody that wants to come to America from a country that they've grown up in that has laws like this, and how do we reconcile whether or not they come here wanting to bring their laws with them, or whether they want to, in fact, become citizens and assimilate? You can't determine what's in somebody's heart, can you?
Well, I think it's ingrained. You know, you look at the Boston bombers, the guys that did that horrible, horrible act during the Boston Marathon. The one of them was really young. The other was young. And they became radical. You know, something happened to them over a period of time, but they became something that was very evil, and it happened very quickly. And you wonder, how does this happen? But one of them was a very, very young person.
Yeah.
And you see the damage they've done. This is why I've been saying we cannot take the people from Syria as much as we want to, because from a heart standpoint, you want, and let's help out, and let's get a lot of other people to put up the money, because they have plenty of money in the Gulf states and a lot of money over there. And we don't, because we're a debtor nation. But we got to help, you know, people. But how can we take in thousands and thousands of people where we have no documentation and nobody knows who they are or where they come from?
And it's even
who knows what we're getting?
And how can you argue with that? That's leadership. That's analysis. It's not pie in the sky. Trump saying it's the president is pathetic. His motives, nobody knows what's going on with him. There's a kind of leadership that helps people, and there's a kind of leadership that hurts people. And I'm afraid that before we get done with this guy at the helm of our country, we're going to suffer some massive reversal that we won't be able to recover from. That's what I'm afraid of. But although I don't claim to know what it would be, but it just seems to me like he has he's not worried in the least about putting Americans in harm's way, as long as he's got excuse for it just seems so weird to me. Anyway, 634, you're listening to AM Las Cruces on 1450 KOBE. Kelly O'Connell, 523-1450, 523-1450, call in. Especially call in if you disagree. We'll be right back.
Tristeza não tem fim, felicidade sim.
All right, so this lady Kendra Shahan, who sparked a standoff. I'm going to tell you something. You're not going to believe it. All right. So they went to the authorities went to the house where she had a knife. She was holding a knife against a couple, causing a standoff with law enforcement. All right. And then she escapes, even though the authorities had put up a perimeter. And they had even sent in robots to try to talk to her. And I want to know how she escaped, bearing in mind that she's described as being 5'6" tall and 300 pounds. I'm really curious about that. I wonder what her time in the 40 is. So here is Nancy Pelosi. You know, you've heard of the go-to move. Somebody has a go-to move. They always go to that. It's their fallback position, or it's their. So for the Democrats, the fallback position is that the problem with violence is guns, and that, you know, guns kill people. And whether it is somebody going postal, or some maniac on psych meds or whatever, or a Muslim terrorist, there's no difference between these people. The problem is guns. Here's Nancy Pelosi. Here's Nancy Pelosi, who I wonder how she lives with herself. She and the president and Harry Reid have overseen the largest downsizing probably in Democratic history of their own party.
Yesterday, our nation witnessed yet another act.
And she sounds to me like Mr. Rogers on, like, after he comes off a crack bender.
Act of unfathomable violence. The shooting in San Bernardino tears at the hearts of all Americans. We all pray for the swift recovery of the wounded. We pray for those who lost their lives, and we feel the grief of their families. Gun violence is a crisis of epidemic proportion in our nation. We've had far too many moments of silence on the floor of the House. And while it is right to respectfully acknowledge the losses, we can no longer remain silent. What gives us the right to hold moments of silence when we do nothing to act upon the cause of the grief?
All right, which begs the question, what's the cause of the grief? Does this woman think if there weren't guns, there wouldn't be radical Muslims running around blowing people up? It's always curious why people become socialists. You know, I don't see the beauty in it. There's this interesting thing. There's this interesting series of contradictions in the history of socialism, one of which is this peace movement, this disarmament movement that the socialists in this country and around the world have demanded that the citizens have their weapons taken away to make the world safer. If you look in the history of socialism, it appears that they picked up this kind of pacifism movement out of the so-called peace churches, which would include the Quakers. But there's no Christianity in socialism, so why are they pacifist? And the answer is, they're really not pacifist. The most brutal wars in history have been started by people with essentially socialist orientation, and the most brutal treatment of their own people, who desperately needed weapons to protect themselves, comes out of this socialist net, you know, this kind of this matrix. If you look at Nazism, if you look at communism, fascism, you know, this stuff has roots in these socialistic writers. The difference between, you know, don't for a minute believe that the Nazis were on the right wing and the communists were on the left wing. Nothing could be further from the truth. They're almost indistinguishable. The only difference between them is whether they allow people to own their businesses and work for the government, or whether the government takes over the business. So here is a response from Rudy Giuliani to Nancy Pelosi's obnoxious statements. And it's just, you know, Nancy Pelosi, is, I've heard her called an idiot more than probably just about any person I've ever heard commenting on. But here's Rudy Giuliani. If you can't see, this was an act of terror, you're a moron.
A lot to go over here now. Loretta Lynch did not say much 25 minutes ago. How much information do the feds have right now?
Well, they have a great deal of information. All we can go on is the public information that we have. So you can come to one clear conclusion that neither one of them came to right away. This is an act of terror. Question is motivation. Was it motivated by the attacks that ISIS is calling for, these individual jihadists attacking us and doing it all over America? They just called for yesterday and the day before. It's written every day if you bother to read their blogs and you pay attention to their literature. So the question here is it an act of terror? We're beyond that. When you've got two assault weapons, two handguns, you're in body armor, you got a home that's booby-trapped, you've been practicing to do this, sure, it may have been motivated by some argument in a party. This is a premeditated act of
terror. May or may not have been. If you put the pieces together, his wife drove the vehicle to the facility,
right,
in all likelihood, because that's why he left the meeting. It went outside, and perhaps that's when he changed and got armored up. Does that make sense to you?
It makes sense to me as an act of terror. If you can't come to the conclusion at this point that this is an act of terror, you should find something else to do for a living than being in law enforcement. I mean, you're a moron. I mean, this is an act of terror without any question. Two assault weapons, two handguns, booby-trapped home, body armor, a home that looks like they were preparing for war or some kind of battle. So it's an act of terror. The real question is, what's the motivation? Is this part of, is ISIL, the Islamic State's plot? Is it part of some other plot? Is it homegrown jihadism, or is it just insanity? Those are the issues that are out there. There are a lot of suggestions that it has a connection to their Islamic faith. He went to Saudi Arabia. He got an online bride in Saudi Arabia. These are tactics that are taught by the Islamic State. These are tactics that are encouraged by the Islamic State. So those things would suggest you got to look at that very carefully. Now, there's where the FBI and the CIA is going to have a lot of information that we don't have, where it's irresponsible for us to draw a conclusion on.
All right. So I'm just going to say it's got to be that it is an act of terrorism in support of worldwide jihad. I mean, here's the thing. They were blowing up. You could hear these loud explosions during this firefight with the police, and they were throwing bombs out of their car. I mean, how long would it take to figure out how to make a bomb and get the stuff for it? It would take more than a few weeks, which is when he got in this big argument with this guy. But, you know, if your home is booby-trapped, then you know you're not coming back to it. And if you go out and shoot a bunch of people in broad, you know, just out in the open up in your purpose is to die. They went home, the police found him, they chased him down to a residential neighborhood, and then there was this incredible firefight, and I think they still had 500 or 1,000 rounds in the vehicle. They found 12 bombs, body armor. I mean, this thing was probably realistically planned for months, if not years. So what's his purpose? He's a very observant, very religious Muslim. And if he adheres to the old ways, and we know that he does because he wanted a wife that wore a hijab, he wanted a wife that was completely observant, meaning that he follows the primitive faith or the old ways, then his purpose would be by just deduction to help create a worldwide Muslim state. That's the purpose. Because I told you yesterday, there is the house of God and the house of war. There's the house of the believers and unbelievers. there's Dar es Salaam, and then there's the House of the Harbi. The Harbis are the enemy combatants. So it's not a highly complicated theory of life. It's just radically different, and it takes us back 1,000 years. There's no nation state in the theory of Islam. They don't accept democracy, and if they're a true believer, they don't want democracy. They want leadership by a strong man, and there is no nation state. So you can't fight for your state. All you can fight for is God. That's the traditional belief. 647 Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, 1450. 523-1450, 523-1450. We'll be right back.
Tristeza não tem fim, felicidade sim. Felicidade como a pluma que o vento vai levando.
Kelly here, and so there was a game, an epic game last night between the Packers and the Lions, which was it was won by Aaron Rodgers with a 61-yard walk-off touchdown, and just a few seconds left in the game, but the opposing party, the Lions, had created a penalty. A guy had a face mask, Rodgers, so they gave them one more play, and they won on that play. Check this out.
Can the receivers get far enough down the field?
Rodgers in trouble. It's going to get to him. He turned 32 yesterday. Does he have a vintage moment in him? In the end zone, little cup for the win. Richard Rodgers with a walk-off touchdown. A game ender for the Packers. Total disbelief at Ford Field. The Packers saved by the face mask call, given one last chance. And Aaron Rodgers heaves it as far as he can. And Richard Rodgers boxing out in the end zone for the touchdown. The son of a former Cal football player who was involved in the band play, one of the all-time game enders in football history, the Stanford Cal game of years ago, 1982. Now the son comes up with the play of his own. Well, right from the start, again, you let Aaron Rodgers out of the pocket.
Well, they let Aaron Rodgers out of the pocket, so... So anyway, what do you think? 523-1450. I'll ask you next hour as well. 523-1450 for what you think that we should do to protect ourselves from radical Islam. How many sleeper cells are in America? Donald Trump is absolutely right. We shouldn't be apologizing for talking about this. If we don't talk about it, how can we ever hope to deal with it? These people are probably indistinguishable from thousands or millions of other people in the country that have Muslim beliefs. And I mean, if you're a traditionalist, you do believe in jihad. And if you are a traditionalist, you don't believe in the nation state, for example. You don't believe America has its own standing. And you would believe that the only person who has standing is a Muslim who is at right, is in agreement with Allah, is in right standing with Allah. And so... You know, the question, and you heard Trump say it, we'd love to help these people, but how can you bring people into your country? You don't know anything about their background, but their background could quite easily be radical Islam, in which they don't accept the authority of any state other than the state of God, the state of Allah. You know, I mean, how can you bring in hundreds, thousands, maybe even millions of these people over a decade? You're going to have, in my opinion, it goes without saying that you're going to have countless examples of this type of thing. And I will guarantee you one thing: ISIS would like that. We know that. Al-Qaeda would like that. We know that because they did it to the country already from outside. And that's what they want. They want world domination. They want the world to be taken over for God. And how seriously are we taking this? How seriously are we taking their beliefs? I mean, at our peril, we turn our back, or we laugh at, we dismiss. We call the threat silly. We say, you know, you're afraid of five-year-olds and widows. At our peril, we make those kind of comments. How seriously are we taking? Do we at least give these people the respect of allowing them to believe what they believe? Do we respect their commitment to their beliefs? In other words, do we take them seriously at their word? Do we really think everybody who moves from the Middle East is instantly going to become a supporter of democracy and pluralism and freedom of religion? At our peril and at the cost of our very lives, we might find out differently. I believe we will find out differently if we don't take this seriously. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE, 523-1450, 523-1450. We'll be back on the break of the hour, and I'm going to get into some jihad teaching.
Oh, what a living. mais ter na vida breve. Precisa a caixa vento se ferrar. A felicidade do pobre parece a grande ilusão do carnaval. A gente trabalha o ano inteiro por um momento de sonho pra fazer a fantasia de rei ou de pirata ou jardineira. E tudo se acaba. Thank you.
7:06, and it's a little bit chilly outside. I've got 29 degrees here. All right, for some New Mexico news, there was an explosion reported on December the 3rd from the KOAT site. Carlsbad, there was an explosion right across the border in Orla, Texas, about 4 miles from the border. A natural gas plant exploded, and people who were there said they saw a fire and started running, and then there's an explosion. It was absolutely crazy. Amazingly, and this is a picture of it, massive fire, absolutely massive fire. No one was injured. Judge in New Mexico, district court judge, Santa Fe, put in an injunction against New Mexico's teacher evaluation system because of the ongoing case that is involved with that, and there will not be any evaluations until they've settled the case or the case has had an outcome. And the American Federation of Teachers of New Mexico and the Albuquerque Teachers Federation were looking for an injunction while their lawsuit against the evaluation system went through the courts. And they claim that the evaluation system is forcing veteran educators to retire or have their licenses jeopardized. And there is a settlement for Luminant, the parent of Luminant company, over an old uranium mine. They're going to give $2 million to clean up the mine, which doesn't sound like much, but the upshot is that it's an old mine, and the company went through bankruptcy. So there is a report. New Mexico has the worst run state government, and this is from SantaFeNewMexican.com. And according to the report published at 24/7 Wall Street, New Mexico is the worst run state. And this is a quote: New Mexico is the worst run state in the country with some of the worst social and economic outcomes. Here's part of what the report said. Only a handful of states struggle with a similar level of extreme poverty as New Mexico. More than one in every 10 households in the state earns less than $10,000 each year, the second highest proportion after Mississippi. The state also struggles with one of the nation's highest violent crime rates. Close to 600 violent crimes are reported each year per 100,000 state residents, one of the highest in the nation. Like a number of other states towards the bottom of this list, more people left New Mexico than arrived from April of 2010 through the middle of last year. Only Illinois reported a larger net population decline during that period. And here is some other aspects of this report. Debt per capita, $3,468, the 22nd highest in the country. Credit rating, AA plus AA, or just AA plus. Unemployment rate, 6.8%, second highest in the nation. Median household income, $44,000 a year. Eighth lowest. Poverty rate, 21.3%, second highest. And Susanna Martinez was asked about this report, and she and her spokesman said, "The governor is working to reform and improve education because it is the key to lift people and their families out of poverty. And we are working to make our economy less dependent on the dysfunction in Washington, D.C. by attracting more job creators and creating more private sector employment. She encourages all those who have simply embraced the decades-long failed status quo to choose reform instead." And we do have a phone call here. Thanks for the call. The Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
Jerry. Good morning, Kelly.
Morning, Jerry. What's up?
Hey, that status of New Mexico has been that way since around 1970s. I grew up in New Mexico, and every year they come out with something like that. It's us, Mississippi, Alabama, and Louisiana. We are the bottom three states every year. So,
well, it's usually stability is a good thing.
Yeah. Well, and I don't think it's blamed on the governor, because this also happened under the last governor, Richardson, but he was also doing other things that were really illegal. And that's where the problem is.
The illegality?
Yeah, well, it's the corruption in government is what I'm saying.
And what kind
and
of
it's not just
Jerry, what kind of corruption are you pointing at?
Well, like pay to play, when they built that railroad up there from Santa Fe to Albuquerque and down to Belen, and then also construction along the highways that Richardson was doing. Now, I have no idea if Susana Martina is doing any corruption, but there's other people in the place, local senators, local representatives of the state house, that are also corrupt.
Well, that's too bad.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, Jerry. Have a good day. All right. Well, as they say, a new broom sweeps clean. All right. So, you know, get some new people in office. I heard that the gay evangelist, what's his name, Bill McCamley, is asking for Syrian refugees to be sent here. Send us all your Syrians, please. Please, Mr. President. Filmmaker Eastwood filming at Holloman. Actor and filmmaker Clint Eastwood was at Holloman Air Force Base shooting footage for the upcoming movie on the story of American pilot Chesley Sully Sullenberger on Wednesday. And that was the guy that flew the plane into the river, the New York River, at the Hudson River. And after the plane struck a flock of Canadian geese, all 155 passengers on board survived the landing. And wow, that sounds fantastic. So we'll look forward to that movie. All right, so we'll come back, and I've got some jihad. I figured that you would. I've got a couple of clips to give you a little background on jihad. What is jihad? What is jihad anyway? So we'll come back and deal with that. 713, 714, Kelly O'Connell Show, AM Las Cruces, 1450, KOBE, 523-1450, 523-1450. It's 713. Today is the fourth day of December, and it is about 30 degrees outside.
Meu coração foi caminho abandonado, onde ninguém mais queria seguir e aventurar. Foi pelas pedras do rio, olhando as nuvens no ar, você chegou por chegar, tirando o pó dos canteiros.
All right, so local politicians asking for Syrians.
Hello, Mr. President, please. We need some more Syrians here. They're pretty dang cute. Please send us some Syrians.
All right, do we need Syrians around here? According to Donald Trump, we don't, because we don't know what they believe. Would we want, is there a humanitarian argument, say, to bring in tens of millions of people who believe in Islam into the country? Do you think? 5, 2, 3, 14, 50. But here is, what is jihad? I'm going to dig into what jihad is, which is the foundation of all of these attacks across the world. The fight for God.
Curious question. What is jihad?
Jihad is to strive. It's found in the Quran. It's certainly there is no reference that I can see, and certainly people have tried to find it, that it's internal striving. Jihad is foremost striving in the cause of Allah, and it's all through the Quran, especially Surah 9, which is the last surah, the last book to have been written according to Islamic Jewish prudence. And so therefore it's endemic in the Quran. Now, when you say strive, that means you must strive with everything that you contain. It could be with your wealth, but you always strive to bring Dar al-Islam into Dar al-Harb. Dar al-Harb means house of war. That's what everything is outside of Islam. Dar al-Islam means house of Islam. And you want to create Islam, and you want to take over the house of war. And that's how you use jihad. Now, there are three major methods or three methodologies in jihad, and it follows the Prophet's life. That's what most of my radical Muslims tell me. They say when he was in Mecca from 610 to 622, that first 12 years that he received his revelations, that was the first form of dakhwa. And dakhwa is a form, is the evangelistic word to invite. That's the first form of jihad. And it's just using they give the symbol of the pen. So it's using anything that talks about Islam. It could be today, it could be using internet, it could be using DVDs, satellite, radio, television, anything that's media-oriented, that's the first form of jihad. When he moved to Medina then, he started implementing his laws and rules and regulations for the first 2 years he was there, between 622 and 624. And the image they give of that is the scale. So that's where laws are starting to be imposed. That's what they're trying to do now in Britain. The Incitement to Religious Hatred Law in 2006, that was beginning of the second form of jihad or dakhwa. And then in 624, when that didn't work, then he started actually using the sword. So that's the third image. So you have the pen, the scale, and the sword. Now the sword was what he started implementing in 624, because he now controlled the environment. He controlled the Ansar, the people that invited him there. He controlled the Jews that were there. He controlled Medina. And once he started controlling Medina, not only publicly, politically, also theologically, then he started moving out and using the sword right, left, and center for the last 8 years. So jihad has three different forms. Muslims will tell you that in the West, we're still in the first area of jihad, but we're soon moving in Europe into the second form of jihad. Sooner or later, we're going to move to the third form of jihad. And that's why we need to be aware of it. We need to know that a lot of it comes from the Prophet's own example, and it comes right in the Quran. Verse after verse after verse, I can quote to you that supports that.
All right, that is jihad. And just to give you a little background on this, he said some stuff that you could use some added info on. Muhammad marries this lady when he was 25 years old. Muhammad was kind of an orphan. I think he was raised by an uncle. 25 years old, he marries a lady who is 15 years older than him. And I think she's 40, and she's got a trading company. She's got camels and such. And so at this point, he starts to have a life of leisure. He goes out into the desert and spend time by himself. And it is common in the tribal area that there would be somebody in the tribes who would be a soothsayer or who would be a holy man. So he started to kind of encroach on that. Well, he had something happen to him. He had a vision, he had a revelation, but basically trances, these visions. And he came back and told his wife about it. And he said, I feel like Satan is basically tormenting me. And his wife said, why? And he told her what happened. And she said, honey, that's got to be God. So he continues to go out and have the experiences. Now, some modern experts think or believe that he had a medical condition that helped cause these visions, and that he was epileptic, that he would have these visions. He would fall down on the ground and you know, kind of black out and foam from the mouth. Of course, Muslims don't accept that at all. Then he started telling people about this, and he got this follower, Abu Baker, which I think was his uncle too, to follow him. And then he started building up, and then he confronted the people in the town. It was a pilgrimage site. There were all kinds of different deities that were worshiped there and that people had gone to visit. He confronted these people to get rid of all these different deities. He said there's only one God. And this created a battle, a fight that he was not prepared for. So the people of the town were basically kind of rising up to kill him because he was trying to wipe out their source of income. And so he went to Medina, the city of refuge. And first he encountered Jews, and he explained to them that it was revealed to him that he was the Messiah that the Bible had talked about. And they said, well, are you Jewish? Or pardon me, are you from the line of David? And he said, no. And they said, well, our Messiah comes from the line of David, according to Isaiah. And then they said, are you Jewish? And he said, no. And they said, well, our Messiah, by definition, is Jewish. So, you know, they laughed at him, and he got very angry. Then he went in with the Christians, and the Christians treated him with more respect and some more care, of course, did not accept the fact, putting forward that he was the Messiah of the Bible. So then he kind of builds up his energies and his followers, and then they go back to Mecca, and they have the Battle of the Trench, where they dig this big trench out, and they kind of lure these people, kind of military force from Mecca, and they get these people to fall in the trench, and then there's a lot of people that are slaughtered. Then he goes back and he settles with the Jews, and he cuts off something like 700 or 800. He beheads about 700 or 800 Jews, and the reason they think that happened was that because they refused to accept him as a leader, and he enslaved the children and turned the wives into concubines, sex slaves. That's the background of where Islam comes from. After that period, as this last commentator had said, he then is interested in converting people by the sword. And according to Muslim theology, there's nothing wrong with that. Now, here is Frank Gaffney. They found an article or a plan basically in the trunk of a car. And it talked about, and this is going back a few years, 3 or 4 years ago, on civilization jihad in America. So they know what the Muslim Brotherhood's plan is for America. And Frank Gaffney is, I think Frank Gaffney was for Bush. He was an expert on Islam and international religion, something like that.
What is jihad? According to these sorts of sources, the sacred texts, the jurisprudence, the traditions, and the practice going back some 1,400 years that make up the authoritative doctrine known as Sharia. Jihad means one thing. And you may have heard from such Muslim scholars as George W. Bush and Barack Obama that what it means is personal struggle to be the best Muslim you can be. But all of these sources say it actually means holy war. And it manifests itself in things like this. Of course, one of the iconic, horrible moments of violent jihad against us. In this, the attack described by our government as workplace violence, a massacre wrought by a jihadist, a man who said he was a jihadist, not only on the occasion and afterwards, but in the run-up to it, in his presentations to some of his comrades in arms, that he was going to kill them in order to defend his faith against what they were going to do to Muslims in Afghanistan. Then, of course, recently, this episode of jihadists trying to murder people engaging in the exercise of free expression in our country. But I want to get at something else, which is really important, and that is that if you're not powerful enough as a Muslim to jihad. And let me emphasize, not all Muslims buy that they're supposed to do this. They don't embrace Sharia. They don't believe that it is their God-directed way to conduct themselves. But if they do, believe that God has ordered them to engage in jihad to achieve the submission of the rest of the world, but they're just not powerful enough to do it, the preferred way, the violent way, what are they supposed to do then? Well, these guys, the Muslim Brotherhood, have a program that they recommend. They call it Civilization Jihad. What is it? Well, it's been described in a document that was providentially discovered in a secret sub-basement in a suburb of Washington, D.C., not far from where Mason, Ty, and Claire live, Annandale, Virginia. As a result of a truly providential traffic stop back in 2004, this document is a secret plan that the Muslim Brotherhood did not expect us to ever see. It was meant as a report from their senior leadership here in the United States back to the mothership in Egypt. And among other things, it laid out how the Muslim Brotherhood was going to accomplish this mission statement. I don't know if you can read it, but it says the following, that they are engaged, the Brotherhood, in America in a kind of civilization jihad, in eliminating and destroying Western civilization from within. By their hands, meaning ours, and the hands of the believers, so that God's religion is made victorious over all other religions. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't consider that to be particularly friendly or benign or the kind of attitude that you think of as the sort of people that you can safely do business with. These are some of the examples of what civilization jihad involves in practice. I'm going to talk a little bit about the first in detail, but let me just mention a couple of hit the second one, actually, too. Educational vehicles, figuring out ways to get inside our academic institutions to promote a favorable understanding of Islam and diminish a more realistic view of what the jihadists are up to. Getting Sharia into our courts, Hijra colonization of America, interfaith dialogue, Sharia-compliant finance. These are lots of different pieces. We don't have time.
All right, so just a little bit. That's kind of scary, though. It's an idea that they're pounding away at us, and we don't even know it. But of course they are. They want to take the world over. 732, Kelly O'Connell Show, AM Las Cruces, 1450, KOBE. 523-1450, 523-1450. We'll come back. I'll give you a little bit more insight into jihad.
Mas queria seguir e aventurar mais. Seu canto foi meu calor pra iluminar o lugar, pra desatar minha dor, desatar meu mundo.
It's 7:35. It's about 30 degrees outside. And we still are trying to figure out exactly what happened in San Bernardino, but we know it had something to do with Islam because the guy was very, 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 very religious person, and it'll all come out. He had contact with terrorists, international terrorists. So, by the way, Texas contacted a group called the International Rescue Committee. Who has let them know that they're bringing Syrians into Texas. And the Governor Abbott has vowed that he's going to block this and let them know if they try, there's going to be a lawsuit. And they sent him a letter. Your agency insists on resettling certain refugees from Syria in the near future. I must ask you that you fulfill your statutory duty to conduct your activities in parentheses in close cooperation and advance consultation with the state of Texas. And that was from the State Health and Human Services Commissioner, Chris Taylor. And he asked them to reply in the near future. But here's the thing. Let me ask you something. Does the Constitution instruct that the president has the right to do something like bring in refugees and stick them in whatever state he wants without their permission? All right. If the Constitution does not address that, according to the 10th Amendment, does it leave it to the states or the president? And what should governors do if they don't want these Syrians? And, you know, I mean, do you think it's the right thing to do to bring these people in and force them on states if they don't want it? Is there something in this vision of leftism that's true that we need to think about and accept and get over ourselves? Or should there be a fight back? 523-1450. Now, here's from a guy that knew Farouk, considered him to be a friend, was sitting next to him at a table, and just happened to get up and use the bathroom when Farouk came to shoot everybody.
To hear more from survivor Patrick Bakari, who we heard from briefly in Miguel's report a few moments ago, he shared a cubicle with his coworker, Saeed Farouk, and they were sitting at the same banquet table before Farouk suddenly disappeared. A trip to the bathroom may have saved Bakari's life because the horror was unfolding on the other side of the door.
Somebody asked, well, where's Saeed? Well, I didn't realize he wasn't there at the moment. I left to use the restroom. I hear explosions. The wall's pummeling. I look back at the mirror. I see I'm bloodied on my face. We just secured the restroom so nobody could enter.
How?
I laid on the floor and put my feet against the door. And I had the other gentleman beside me do the same.
Did the gunman come into the restroom?
He wasn't going to be able to get in. I guess if he did, he'd been over our dead bodies. When the SWAT team finally came, basically tried to run as fast as we could away from the building. And I told them I was a medic, and one of my good friends there, she was shot. And so I tried to render her aid with what minimal equipment we had. She got shot multiple times, and we could see the bullets lodged under the skin on her wrists, and that wasn't where the entries were. Just take each day as cherished as can be.
Patrick Bakari describing the massacre that claimed the lives of so many of his colleagues.
Now, this Bakari guy, Bakari had, in another interview, had talked about, you know, the fact that when his wife got pregnant, they had a baby shower for the baby. And so he was very, very upset, you know, that how do people decision make in these type of situations when you think you know somebody, obviously you don't. And, you know, he could not understand, and I'm sure that it would be true of a lot of people, that they couldn't understand the motivations of someone who would be your friend and yet couldn't wait to kill you when they had a opportunity. Now, here's a little bit from this civilization jihad. And this is just from last year.
Well, when you head into the voting booth, what do you see on the ballot? Democrat, Republican, Muslim Brotherhood? We're one step closer to that reality, according to our next guest.
Yes, say what? Our next guest says radical Islamists are busy building a voting bloc to sneak their political agenda into the American system. Their goal? To wage jihad from within. Retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Alan West is Fox News contributor, joins us today from beautiful Boynton Beach, Florida. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning. How are you doing, Steve and Elizabeth?
We're doing okay now until we're going to find out about what you're suggesting is going on in American politics. Tell us about this.
Well, you have the formulation of the U.S. Council of Muslim Organizations, and it's very disconcerting. Because back in 1991, there was a document that was written, and it was called the Explanatory Memorandum for the Strategic Goal of the Group or the Brotherhood in North America. And during an FBI raid in 2007 in Northern Virginia, this document was uncovered, translated into English, and we come to find out it's the blueprint, the campaign strategy for the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States of America. And the groups that are forming this new council of Muslim organizations like CARE, the Council for American Islamic Relations, Muslim American Society, Islamic Society of Northern America, all of them have ties back to the Muslim Brotherhood. As a matter of fact, CARE is an unindicted co-conspirator in the largest terrorist funding case, the Holy Land Foundation case in the United States of America. And you know, recently, CARE has, you know, gone out and protested against a documentary like The Honor Diaries being shown and, you know, campaigned heavily against Ayaan Hirsi Ali at Brandeis University to get that honorary degree. But now they're forming some type of political party, a voting bloc, as
in
they call it.
In this country.
The institutionalized party. That's right. The institutionalized policies that favor them.
Right. And one of them actually had a quote, a statement on bin Laden, calling him a visionary. They said he was a visionary who believed in the possibility of an Islamic state in Afghanistan, the possibility that this thing might someday be. There was nothing wrong with that dream, even if it differs from that one that all Americans have here for themselves. Certainly disconcerting. You write in a piece, too, that this is a method to destroy from within. This is not a new philosophy. It has been going on and is in process.
Yeah, well, that's what the strategic memorandum says, that they would destroy America from within using a civilizational jihad, and that's exactly what you see happening. As a matter of fact, the chairman of this new Council for Muslim Organizations, Qassam Jamal, is tied back to the infamous Bridgeview Mosque in Chicago, which once hosted the spiritual mentor of Osama bin Laden. So all of these things are happening right under our nose, and for whatever reason, we have politicians that don't want to confront and don't want to combat this issue.
Well, it's easier to let it go and just hope for the best, but realistically speaking, how long are we going to bury our heads? And we do have a phone call. Thanks for the call, the Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
This is Jerry again, Kelly.
Yeah, briefly.
My question to you is, did you say that the first step of Islam is to go out and try to persuade people or teach people about Islam
well,
to convert?
That was one of the – this and it's on the it's on YouTube. I'll find the name of it, but it was a little clip.
Okay.
But yeah, there
okay,
were
three.
Three steps. The first one is through persuasion. The second one is through law, and the third one is through war.
Okay. The reason why I ask that is because 3, 4, 6 months ago, there was a report coming out of UNM, University of New Mexico, where they were holding an Islamic education seminar in the University of New Mexico. And they had confrontation type of thing where, afterwards where people put it on the YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
And they were upset about that. I've seen it on a newscast, local newscast down here.
I'll have to sniff that one out. Thanks, Jerry. Good call there. We'll see if I can find that for you. We'll take a little break here and come back. And I've got 10 verses that explain that you can compare to ISIS and see if they're following the Quran. 745 Kelly O'Connell Show, AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE, 523-1450. And I know there's a lot of Muslims or at least a lot of Middle Easterners that are attending UNM. Maybe we can get some of them on the show. We'll be back and get into those 10 surahs, the sectioning of the Holy Quran. Okay, so, and I've just found some of the things Jerry was talking about, so I might be able to play a little bit, but here is top 10 Quran verses for understanding ISIS.
If you really want to understand the rape and slaughter being committed in the name of Allah by the Islamic State, you have to study the history of Muhammad and his companions, a history found in the Hadith and the Sirah literature. But you can get a pretty good outline of the Islamic State's message and tactics by reading the Quran, which Muslims believe to be the direct word of Allah. For those of you who don't have time to read the Quran, here's a top 10 list of the most essential verses for understanding ISIS. In the Bible, Jesus says that God loves everyone. In the Quran, not so much. Surah 3, verse 32. Say, obey Allah and the Apostle. But if they turn back, then surely Allah does not love the unbelievers. According to the Quran, Allah only loves obedient Muslims. I wonder why ISIS doesn't seem to have much love for non-Muslims. Believe it or not, Allah's complete lack of love for non-Muslims plays a role in how non-Muslims are to be treated. Surah 48, verse 29. Muhammad is the messenger of Allah, and those who are with him are severe against unbelievers and merciful among themselves. Those who are with Muhammad, i.e. Muslims, are severe against whom? Against unbelievers. They're merciful to whom? Only to their fellow Muslims. But politicians and the media just can't figure out why ISIS is so severe against non-Muslims. There are lots of ways to be severe against unbelievers. Here's one, Surah 4, verse 24. Also forbidden are women already married, except those captives and slaves whom your right hands possess. This may be confusing without the historical context, which you can read in Sunan Abu Dawud 2150. When Muhammad won the Battle of Altas, Allah had already revealed that Muslims were free to rape their female captives. But at Altas, the Muslim army captured certain women along with their husbands, and some of the Muslims started wondering if raping these women counted as adultery because they were married. That's when Allah revealed Surah 4, verse 24, which says that married women are indeed forbidden as sex partners unless they're your captives. If they're your captives, rape them all you want. Allah couldn't conceivably care less that they're married. Heard about any groups raping their female captives recently? What about people who try to stop the Islamic State from establishing Sharia? Surah 5, verse 33. The punishment of those who wage war against Allah and his apostle and strive to make mischief in the land is only this, that they should be murdered or crucified, or their hands and their feet should be cut off on opposite sides, or they should be imprisoned. This shall be as a disgrace for them in this world, and in the hereafter they shall have a grievous chastisement. Notice that there are several penalties, including death, crucifixion, and dismemberment, for the vague crime of making mischief in the land. Since the crime is vague, Muslim groups like ISIS can pack all kinds of offenses into this verse. And yet, the U.S. State Department just put out a video making fun of ISIS for crucifying their enemies. When Muhammad was completely outnumbered, he had to put up with idolaters. But once he had the most powerful army in Arabia, the message of Islam became convert or die. Surah 9, verse 5 contains Allah's final marching orders on dealing with idolaters. When the sacred months have passed, slay the idolaters wherever you find them and take them captive and besiege them and prepare for them each ambush. But if they repent and establish worship and pay the poor due, then leave their way free. Lo, Allah is forgiving, merciful. So kill them unless they convert to Islam. Sound familiar?
All right. Well, maybe we'll do the other five next week. We'll take a little break here, and I'm going to play a little bit of the UNM stuff if I can get a good clip. AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE. All right, I found a little clip here. It's from a video called Controversial Video About UNM Muslim Student Association Goes Viral. And from April 2nd, 2015, so just a few months ago, check it out.
I'm a big old redneck.
Sophomore Michael Guevara isn't shy about letting you know what he thinks.
I drive a truck. I love America. I love God, and I shoot guns.
Just overnight, he's let about 50,000 people know what he thinks.
They are against the U.S.
When he saw a panel about ISIS in the student union building, he started recording.
This is disturbing, people. This is very disturbing. I am not okay with this as an American. I think we as a people should be scared. This is the University of New Mexico.
Fear is exactly what the Muslim Student Association says it was trying to address by holding a panel about ISIS.
We don't condone anything that ISIS does. We are against everything that they do. You know, Islam does not promote violence.
The association says during the panel it addressed religion, politics, and the roots of extremism. And it says the Facebook post titled Pro-ISIS Panel at UNM has now done the opposite of what they had hoped for.
When you have the invention of Facebook, social media in general, you know, people kind of get bits and pieces of knowledge. And that really, if it forms your perception, then that can be harmful.
Organizers say Christians who sat in and listened to the panel have told them they don't agree with Guevara's post.
Majority of Christians, apart from him, they were surprised. Mm-hmm. They really appreciated the fact that we were outside there and we enlightened the community and we took a stand.
Guevara makes no apologies.
Everything has to be politically correct, everything. We can't go against something, we just have to listen. Why can't we just stand up and say our viewpoints and ask questions and actually start a dialogue?
But the Muslim Student Association says a dialogue is what they didn't get to have with him or the 50,000 people who have watched his video. Tina Jensen, KRQE News 13.
All right, so there you have that one. Interesting, good catch there. I will leave you with a question that I asked yesterday. What should we do about not just what happened in San Bernardino? What should we do to get ready for the future? I will stipulate to the fact that probably the vast majority of Muslims in this country enjoy our freedom and want peace. But what about those who don't? How do we defend ourselves? And how do we keep out the bad ones? We got a phone call. Thanks for the call. We've got very little time. Who's this?
It's Mike.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. It says, Islam is not a religion anymore. It's the world's largest death cult. One other thing, you know you're in a cult when you leave, meaning when you leave, it means you die.
That's true. Thanks for the call, Mike. Great call. All right, folks. So what is the punishment for apostasy in Islam? The females are supposed to be taken and whipped every 3 days at prayer time until they repent. Men are given 3 days to repent or they're beheaded. So, and Samuel Zweimer, Zweimer, has got some phenomenal books on Islam if you want to get specifically on the issue of apostasy. But apostasy is the punishment is death. Nobody's allowed to leave Islam. The natural state of mankind is to believe Islam, but there's no influence from anybody else. You will be naturally Islamic, and you're born into Islam. You don't convert to it. 7:59, have a great day. Kelly O'Connell Show, AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE. I'll see you back in 2 days. Have a great weekend. Thank you.